Commonwealth Attorney Ray Larson with us. Hey, Ray.
Hey, Jack.
Good morning.
How are you?
I'm well. You?
So far, so good.
We've got a Commonwealth Attorney on the phone with us now this morning for the first part of the program that has been on enough that I think she needs to get a card, one of those little carrying cards that goes in your wallet, that she's an official member of our cast.
Well, she's a foreign correspondent.
That's,
you know,
it.
She's from up there in the German part of the state.
Yep.
Linda?
Yes, sir.
Linda Tally Smith is the prosecutor in Boone and Gallatin County. That's Florence Yall in Warsaw, Kentucky.
How you doing?
Very good. How are you today?
Fine. Thanks for being with us.
And we don't have her for long because she has got to go to a very important event up there. It's her daughter's career day.
That's nice. Are you going to try to talk those kids into becoming prosecutors?
I'll probably try to talk them to into running as far away from law enforcement as they possibly can.
she doesn't mean that.
Yeah.
After she fires us here shortly, then Jason Hintz, who is an assistant, a Commonwealth attorney in Linda's office, will take over and talk about this case. So let's take advantage, Linda, of the time we have with you, and give us a little bit of an introduction into the facts of this case.
Okay. This was a case from 2003, and the reason why it's fascinating that Jason Hintz and I got to work this case together is because Jason and I both hail from Carroll, Owen, and Grant counties originally as assistant Commonwealth attorneys down in those rural counties, and he was actually working as an assistant for Jim Crawford down in those three counties while, you know, I was Commonwealth's attorney up here at the time that this happened. And the body of the victim in this case was found in Grant County originally, so jurisdiction was an issue immediately. And very shortly thereafter, I stole Jason from Jim Crawford's office, and he was able to finish this case with me in Gallatin County. But factually speaking, a young lady by the name of Jennifer Miller, she was 23 years old at the time, was murdered in this case by a man by the name of Tony Couch. They had a short-term boyfriend-girlfriend relationship, and in this particular case, you know, we can't really say 100% what happened that resulted in her death, but we believe that the evidence would have shown that she was beaten to death, possibly with a hatchet in this case. They both were frequent users of recreational drugs, and the argument stemmed from the fact that they were arguing over who got the last hit of meth that was available that night. But the investigation itself started on October 6th of 2003 when, as it turns out, the defendant's father called the state police. He owned a big farm in Grant County, and one morning when he was out doing his regular farm work, he noticed a small fire on his property and couldn't figure out who had started a little fire there and went out to investigate. And when he did, his dogs showed interest in something over the hill, and he discovered a body part that he believed to be a human torso and called the state police. And, of course, in rural counties, the state police get calls from people all the time that they think they found a human bone or they found a human body part. And so in a case like this, troopers come out and expect that it's going to be nothing, but they came out and discovered pretty quickly that he was accurate. And so over the course of the next 24 hours, Dr. Emily Craig and others came to help search the farm. And all in all, it was determined that Jennifer's body had been cut up into 64 pieces.
Whoa.
Yeah.
Well, tell us about, so how were they able to identify that it was, if she's cut up in 64 pieces, how did they identify that it was, in fact, Jennifer Miller?
Well, at first they didn't know it was her. At the time, the local media up here in the Cincinnati media market was reporting that a body had been found and that they were searching for it down there. And in that process, Jennifer's family called the state police and said that Jennifer was missing, that they hadn't heard from her in several days, which is unusual because she had a couple of small children. And they said that she, you know, they asked for any unique or identifying marks, and they said that she had a tattoo around her navel of flowers, a wreath around her belly button, basically. And that was information that was never released through the media. And so pretty quickly they were able to determine that they were talking about the right girl because a body part had been found with that same tattoo.
Now, the body wasn't burning. You said that the dad was responding to a fire, but the body wasn't burning, right?
No, it was actually clothing and plastic bags that were burned in the fire.
Okay, so how did we focus on this Tony Couch?
Well, the family reported that she had been dating Tony Couch for the last couple of months, and his trailer was located about 2 miles down the road from his dad's farm. And so the state police went there in the middle of the night. It was about 1 o'clock in the morning when one of the detectives and the post captain and the post lieutenant, which if anybody works with the state police, knows that your workforce is pretty thin when your post captain actually goes out to a scene like that, because usually they don't. And Mr. Couch was asleep when they arrived. They knocked on the door and said that they were looking into the disappearance of Jennifer Miller and wanted to ask him a few questions. He was obviously groggy and tired when they first arrived, but he let him in. And while they started talking, the captain and the lieutenant asked if he wouldn't mind if they looked around, and he said no, that they were free to look wherever they wanted. Something had caught their attention when they first got there. There were brand new, large trash cans with the lids taped down right there in the living room of the trailer. And, you know, they're looking at each other like, ooh, what's this all about? And so when they start looking through the trailer, they found a hatchet on the edge of the bathtub. And then when they entered the bedroom, there was blood everywhere. He basically had used the bedroom as a processing room and, you know, ultimately admitted that he basically parted her out like he would a deer, like field dressing a deer in this particular case to try to get rid of her body. And so...
Parted her out?
Mm-hmm.
Whew.
Yes. Filleted her, deboned her, beheaded her, all of those gruesome things. But, you know, the fascinating thing about the case is what was in those trash cans, because they were brand new. He had actually stopped in the middle of what he was doing and gone out and bought these trash cans because in his bedroom he had his collection of Hot Wheels. They were NASCAR edition Hot Wheels in Lucite boxes on the walls decorating his bedroom. And he went and got these large trash cans to put his Hot Wheels in and cover up because he didn't want to get a mess on his car collection.
Oh, so that's why he got the trash can.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Well, it's good to be a collector.
Yeah. Sure.
Yeah. So, you know, Jack, a lot of our listeners will think, how do they talk about this kind of stuff? Well, this is what we do. And this is the kind of thing we talk about. And so when Linda and I both get angry about the fact that people that are committing crimes are basically not being held responsible to the extent that most people think they should.
Yeah.
That's why we get so frustrated. Linda, you leave whenever you have to leave.
Okay.
So they got there and they, how do they ultimately decide this is the guy?
Well, you know, once they discovered the crime scene in the trailer itself, then they came out and notified the detective that was sitting out there talking with him, because the first story he gave to them was that Jennifer had left his house a couple of nights before and that he hadn't seen her since then. And so once they came out and told him that there was blood and you know, that sort of thing there at the scene, then they went ahead and Mirandized him and told him that it basically the investigation had turned to a murder investigation at this point in time. And so ultimately, by my count, I think he gave them 5 different stories about what happened. You know, one was that he just came home and she was dead. Another was that they got into an argument and she fell and hit her head on a dresser. And he left, and she was fine, and he came home, and she was dead. And then another one was he came home, and she was shooting something up and must have died of an overdose. But ultimately, he acknowledged that they had argued and that they were arguing over drugs, and that he continued to stick with the story that she fell and hit her head on a dresser, but there was no evidence to support that. They actually took the entire dresser as evidence, and based upon the size and the types of wounds that she had, it was the medical examiner's opinion that she had been beaten with some sort of a blunt but occasionally sharp instrument, which they believed to be the hatchet that was in the bathtub.
Well, how did his story square with the idea that she came in pieces?
His story was that he freaked out. That yeah. once he realized she was dead, he didn't know what to do, and so he decided that he needed to cut up her body to hide it, get rid of it, because he had no choice. And you know, the story gets a little bit more gory than that, but I'll leave a good portion of this for Jason to explain to you. And so when we break, I'll let him tag in here on that part.
He really didn't know what he was doing. He made sure to tell the police that he was sober at that time. I mean, he went into detail about how he took the body parts to his dad's farm, that he left them out there. He said he was out at his dad's farm for about a half hour. He told them about how he cut up the body. He told the police that he had to convince himself that she, Miss Miller, Jennifer, was not anything more than an animal. He went into detail about what he did with the body parts that they hadn't recovered yet. He said that he had put some of the body parts on a train. There's a train line that runs right by the farm where this was recovered. And he said that he put some of the body parts on a train and that, you know, the police wouldn't be able to find them. I mean, he was very open about everything except for how she actually died. He made some statements that he had been sitting in his house and was thinking about suicide, was thinking about burning the house down. Obviously, what was important to him was his Hot Wheels collection. He had taken steps to protect that. So I think he knew, and I think he knew that, you know, given the efforts he had gone through to cut up the body, I think he knew that he was going to get caught, and I think he was resigned to his own guilt by the time police showed up.
All right, we're going to take a break. 253-5959, touch *590 from AT&T, toll free from anywhere. We're back with Commonwealth Attorney Ray Larson. On the line with us this morning is Assistant Commonwealth Attorney representing Boone and Gallatin Counties, Jason Hiltz. Ray?
Okay, Jason, so he was charged. So what's the next step?
Well, what happened after that was, the police were still looking for the body. We had found, the police had found a lot of the body parts out on this farm. And, you know, that's kind of one thing that's interesting about this case and some other dismemberment cases we've had, which unfortunately we have a lot of dismemberment cases in this area for some reason. But the police are going through a lot of efforts to make sure they can recover as much of the body as possible.
One of the things that happens, Jack, and this might be interesting, there was a shooting out in the Woodhill area and over by Woodhill Middle School, and there's a field there. And the police were looking for the gun, and what they do is they get their recruit class. And they set up sort of a geometric process where get all of the recruit class, and they space them so that they can cover every bit of the field if it takes two or three trips back and forth. And that's the way they ultimately found the gun in this thing. And that's, I'll bet you, similar to what they tried to do at the looking for this body.
It's very similar. We actually had help from Kenton County Police Department up here in Northern Kentucky. We had the state police. We had the local sheriff's department, all of them out trying to recover whatever we could recover. And part of the statement I talked about before was Mr. Couch had told the police that he had taken some of the body parts and put them on a train. So we had police walking miles of train track up and down Northern Kentucky looking for anything they could find. Ultimately, they were able to recover most of the body, but they're still missing some parts. Tony Couch agreed to talk to the police and take them out where the head had been placed. He was at a spot off the farm. He was in jail at this time. He actually was let out of jail, obviously in police custody, went back out with the police and showed them where the head actually was. He had not actually put it on a train. He had left it in another spot and actually led the police out to locate the head, which, you know, as grisly as it sounds, I think is important when you're talking to a victim's family. I mean, as awful as this is, you want to give them as much closure as you can. And, you know, unfortunately, part of closure in cases like this is, can we recover as much of your loved one as we can? And in this case, we were thankfully able to recover most of the body.
You know, talking about that reminds me of the Trent DeJuro murder. The for many years, that murder case was not solved, and the family just wanted to have some idea of why. I mean, they had the body, but they didn't understand why. And
why it hadn't been solved?
No. Why was the guy? Why was their son killed?
Oh, I see.
What was the motive? And ultimately, they found out, and that was, you know, that was very, just like Jason says, just the family wants the body so that they can bury it, mm-hmm. and begin then the process of trying to grieve. So let me ask you this. Let me just play devil's advocate here. What if he had put all of the body parts on different trains that were heading south or heading north, and ultimately you didn't have a body? Tell me how you're going to deal with that. Would you have to deal with that?
Well, honestly, if he had taken the body parts and put them all on different trains, it would have been a missing persons report until somebody found some body parts on some trains. You know, the way this case got started was because the defendant's father went out to his farm and happened to find some of these body parts. I mean, if he had been able to burn this body better, if he had been able to conceal it better, you know, we'd still be talking about a missing person at this time. I mean, this one, you know, like I said before, we've had a number of dismemberment cases up here. And one of the things that we find in these dismemberment cases is people realize once they get into trying to dismember and conceal a body that it's pretty hard to do. It takes a lot of physical work. It takes a lot of work, period, to do this sort of heinous act. And by the time somebody does it, the dismemberment or parting out of the body, concealing it for a long period of time is a whole other process. And fortunately, and I hate to use that word when you're talking about something like this, but fortunately, in this case, he did not complete the concealment of the body, and we were able to find the body and quickly trace it back. But like you said, if the body had been placed on these trains and sent far away, you know, you find a body part in Alabama, it's going to be pretty hard to trace that back to Northern Kentucky.
Well, that's right. So walk us through. So here we are, and he goes out and takes you where he had left the head. And where do we go from there?
Well, like I said, at that time he was in jail. We were able to recover most of the body, and at this time Dr. Craig is assisting us in identifying the body parts and putting them back together. We were able to identify the victim after finding a body part with a tattoo that matched the description that her family had given. Her family had called her in as a missing persons about the same time that the news was reporting finding a body part. So we were able to recover most of the victim. We were able to identify the victim, and we had the defendant in jail. At this time, the police switched their focus in the investigation to gathering information about the victim and about Tony Couch and their relationship. They spoke to several mutual friends of Mr. Couch and the victim, and gathered some information, which, as you know, working these types of cases yourself, leads to some pretty interesting information. For example, there was a ex-girlfriend of Mr. Couch who told the police that Mr. Couch had actually threatened her about cutting her up and feeding her to the cows. She also told the police that he had threatened her previously with cutting her up and throwing her body parts on a train where she would never be found. Now, what's interesting about that is that interview took place before any of this information was made public, any of the information about him claiming to have put body parts on a train or anything like that. So keep in mind, the defendant's story at this time was that they got into an argument over drugs and that this happened accidentally, well, then you're talking to people who would make statements that he has threatened to do this exact sort of thing in the past. So this is when you're really building your case and finding the evidence of premeditation and that sort of thing.
You know, it's Jack, it's very interesting because typically the information about the previous girlfriend that Jason has just talked about is not admissible in the case involving the death of Jennifer Miller, unless it qualifies under the rules of evidence. And did you all, did this guy go to trial?
He did not. He pled guilty.
All right. But what would happen is you file a motion to allow that as previous bad acts or similar acts, and the chances, I'm not the judge, but I can't imagine that that wouldn't be permitted to be used as evidence in that case had it gone to trial.
No, and it's certainly something we would have tried to introduce because, again, if a defendant's story is this was, you know, one bad moment and I panicked and I did something terrible, that's one thing. But if there's evidence that he's threatened to do this in the past, you know, that's another thing entirely.
All right, we're taking a break. 253-5959, touch star 590 from AT&T. Toll free from anywhere, 1-877-777-0590 or email jackpatty@wvlkam.com. We are back. Ray Larson, Commonwealth Attorney Ray Larson, also Assistant Commonwealth Attorney representing Boone and Gallatin County. Jason Hiltz on the line with us talking about this horrible, horrible murder that occurred back, I believe it was 2003. Is that right, Jason?
That's correct.
Yeah, Ray?
Okay, tell us, Jason, okay, so the case has been investigated thoroughly and that sort of thing. You involved one of our favorites, Emily Craig.
Mm-hmm.
So how do you, and this case was resolved with a guilty plea. Tell me about that.
Well, you know, he was arrested and charged. You know, at this time, he's already given us statements. He's at the scene, so we feel like we have a really strong case. He is represented by at that time, our head public defender up here. And, you know, we went through the normal pretrial motions. There was a motion to suppress some of the statements that he had made, especially statements he had made after he had been arrested. The issue there was, you know, he had been arrested and charged and was represented by an attorney, and could he make statements to the police? Well, we had a hearing on that, and the finding was that he was the one volunteering to give this information to the police, and I'm talking about where we found the head. You know, once he's in jail and has an attorney, he was the one reaching out to us. You know, I can tell you where the head is, that sort of thing.
Well, and that makes a difference, Jack. I mean, if he's represented by an attorney, you can't just go start talking to him without his attorney being present and that sort of thing. And so, but if it's initiated by, in this case, the defendant, then that's a different ball game. But you also better be careful about that sort of thing. Okay, so you talked to the, you had the hearings, so tell us how you ultimately came to have this thing pled.
Well, ultimately he pled guilty to murder, to tampering with physical evidence, and to abuse of a corpse. He received a sentence of 29 years in prison, and he's still in prison there today. You know, we reached that agreement after talking to, you know, the victim's family. We actually spoke some to the defendant's family as well. And you know, this was kind of an unusual situation because one of our key witnesses was actually the defendant's father. He was kind of the one that started this whole thing off. But, you know, in talking to the victim's family, you know, a lot of times there's a balance between wanting, you know, justice for their loved one at the same time. Are they really interested in having a highly publicized trial and all these gruesome things about their loved one coming out, you know, in the public? So after negotiating with the defense attorney and talking to the victim's family, we did reach a plea agreement for 29 years to serve. Felt like that was a just resolution. You know, it's a very gruesome crime. You know, the defendant did ultimately take responsibility for his actions. He did admit to killing the victim in this case. He did admit to committing all of these acts. And he did receive the sentence of 29 years that the Commonwealth recommended.
You know, one of the things that this gives me an opportunity to get back to the old parole business that I just love to berate. But do you know that if he got 24 years, he's eligible for parole in 20 years? If he got 200 life sentences, he's eligible for parole in 20 years.
Really?
Yeah. And so, you know, the fact that there is no truth in sentencing in Kentucky, because the public almost, if you say somebody got a life sentence, most of, well, they don't anymore. They're all very skeptical about it now. But a life sentence in Kentucky means you're eligible for parole in 20 years.
So is this guy eligible this year?
He'll be eligible in 20 years.
That'd be this year, right?
No. He was sentenced when?
Oh, another 10 years.
He was sentenced in 2006.
Okay, all right.
So he's got 20 years before he's eligible. Now, I don't mean he gets it.
Right, right.
But
in 2026,
yeah,
he'll be eligible.
Yeah.
Right. And how old was he when he was convicted?
Oh, let's see.
Just roughly. I mean,
40.
40.
Yeah.
He's about 40, 30.
So at 60, he potentially could be back out on the street.
Yes.
Well, I think, and from the victim's perspective, you don't want to hear about her dope use public. You don't want to hear about the gruesome nature of the whole thing. And a lot of times, victims have a major influence on that.
Jason, thank you for being with us.
Thank you.
You did a good job.
Thank you, Ray. Update from the Information Center coming up next. If you're listening to WVLK AM, stay with us.